Inside Florida Politics, the essential podcast powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, coming to you from our tastefully lighted studio in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I'm joined, as always, by Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson.
Hey, George.
And from Tallahassee by the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief, John Kennedy.
Hi, George.
And I hope the fire marshal isn't listening today, because this podcast is overloaded beyond capacity for talent, because we have a very special guest in studio today, Palm Beach Post staff writer Christine Stapleton.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We got a lot to cover in a very short time. So let's get right to it. You know, there's always a lot of spin that accompanies political polls, but if you're a Republican, it's pretty hard to explain away the fact that there have been 8 or 9 polls since the August 28th primaries, and every one of them shows Democrat Andrew Gillum leading the governor's race over Republican Ron DeSantis. Now, a lot of those polls are close, within the margin of error, but there's an unmistakable pattern. And DeSantis essentially confirmed that this week by bringing in a new person to head his campaign, Susie Wiles. Susie Wiles is well known in the political junkie community, maybe not elsewhere. Two things that podcast listeners should know about her resume. One is that in 2010, when Bill McCollum was the slam dunk Republican establishment favorite to win the GOP nomination for governor, remember him? Susie Wiles was campaign manager for an unknown outsider with bottomless pockets named Rick Scott. And Scott went on to beat McCollum in the primary and win the general election and serve 2 terms as governor. The other Susie Wiles credential worth noting is in 2016, after Donald Trump clinched the Republican nomination for president, and in doing so, he had a very impressive win in Florida's Republican primary. But there was a lot of unease that summer among Republicans about whether Trump could win Florida in the general election. And just after Labor Day that year, the Trump campaign brought in Susie Wiles to head the Florida effort. And Trump, of course, went on to win Florida over Hillary Clinton in the general election by 1.2%, which is in for a top of the ticket race in Florida, that's practically a landslide. So those are two things to know about Susie Wiles. The other thing is she is the daughter of Pat Summerall, the broadcasting legend and former New York Giants player. So also worth noting. John Kennedy and Zach Anderson. John, first, your take on the state of the governor's race and the significance of the what the Susie Wiles hiring means.
Well, it seems like things are sort of at the moment trending Democratic. This week, we had those two polls where Quinnipiac University had Gillum up by 9 over his Republican opponent DeSantis, and Marist NBC had Gillum up by 5%. That's a significant margin to a degree. 5% is still pretty close to a margin of error. The polls also had Bill Nelson on top of Governor Scott much more narrowly. But, what's worth mentioning is also that it seems like almost everybody has made up their minds in these nationally watched races where you only have a sliver of voters, basically a single-digit percentage in both races, saying they haven't made up their minds or are likely to change. So despite all the millions of dollars that are going to be spent on digital advertising, social media, and TV ads, people are kind of set, it seems like, right now.
Yeah, as we've said many times before on the podcast, and we're not afraid of beating a dead horse on the podcast, this is shaping up very much as a base election rather than a, persuade the middle election. It's more about turning out the base. Zach Anderson, your take on the state of the governor's race and DeSantis's campaign and bringing in this new leader with 6 weeks left.
Yeah, no doubt there's a sense that DeSantis's campaign has been struggling. He sort of struggled right off the bat. The day after the election, he went on TV And he used the phrase monkey this up to refer to Andrew Gillum and how his policies would impact the economy. A lot of people thought using the term monkey in conjunction with an African-American candidate was really a racial dog whistle. He denied that, but it sort of set his campaign off on the wrong foot. And then he's had a series of controversies regarding donors and others associated with his campaign who have made racist comments or had some kind of controversial past. Most recently, I went to an event that DeSantis had, a rally in Sarasota just this last Saturday, and there was a big contingent at the rally of this group called the Proud Boys, which is a controversial group. They refer to themselves as white or Western chauvinists.
Proud Boys, is that boys with an S or with a Z?
With an S, yeah. It's not no Z there. Yeah, the Proud Boys, not boys. But they refer to themselves as Western chauvinists who do not apologize for the West being responsible for the creation of the modern world. And they've been associated with things like the protest in Charlottesville, the Unite the Right event that resulted in violence and was a big controversy for President Trump. Some of their members and affiliates were banned from Twitter over extremist views. And so, it's just another group, another association that sort of fits in with this pattern of having controversial individuals associated with them. Now, DeSantis came out this week and said it was unfair, to blame him for a few people that showed up at his rally. And he said that the media has been unfair to him and that they're looking at his associations, but they're not looking at Andrew Gillum's associations. DeSantis adamantly denies that he has any racist beliefs. But it's just been this trend for his campaign, and it's this narrative that has hurt his campaign, I think, from the start. And he's really struggled to gain traction. And Gillum seems to be doing very well in the polls. And one of the things that the Quinnipiac pollster noted is that Gillum, people just seem to like Gillum. There seems to be a likability factor, a charisma there, and so that's helped him. So they bring in Susie Wiles. She helped with Trump's campaign get that across the finish line here in Florida. Obviously, it's not too late to right the ship here. There's plenty of time left, and she is known as a very savvy operative. So it's probably a smart move to shake things up a little bit considering how the race has been trending.
Very good. Yeah, definitely will be an interesting couple of weeks coming up. But right now, I think I hear some kind of funky royalty-free music playing. And listeners to the podcast know that that's the Pick a Number music. That's the segment on the podcast where each of us is going to put forward a number, and then later in the podcast we are going to explain what that number means in Florida politics. So we have a big crew here today. Let's start with Zach Anderson. Do you have a number for us today?
Yeah, I'm gonna go simple this week with a 4.
Okay, Zach Anderson has a 4. And as always, we encourage podcast listeners, as long as you're not driving a car or operating heavy machinery, to take notes. And I'm doing that. Zach Anderson with a 4. John Kennedy, what's your number?
I've got a 76, George.
76 for John Kennedy. Okay. Christine Stapleton, our special guest, is all right if we include her in the Pick a Number segment?
I'm ready.
All right. Let's do it. Christine, what's your number?
My number is 17, and give you a little hint.
No, I'm sorry. There's no hints are allowed.
All right.
On the that'll lead to a disqualification. Zach Anderson almost got booted off for that a couple weeks ago. 17 for Christine Stapleton. And my number, I'm George Bennett, my number is 14. So again, just to review very quickly, Zach, we'll go from lowest to highest. Zach Anderson, 4. George Bennett, that's me, 14. Christine Stapleton, 17, and John Kennedy with the curve buster at 76. You want to stay tuned to the end of the podcast and see what those numbers mean in Florida politics. But let's get back to our loaded lineup here today. As we mentioned before, Christine Stapleton is joining us, and As you know, all guests on the podcast are welcome with the royalty-free surf music that sounds a little bit like Dick Dale's Miserloo. You hear that music playing right now. Christine Stapleton is joining us. Christine, there's a new book out by Bob Woodward, and as a Florida podcast, we're interested just in the Florida parts of it. And you have read the book, and tell us, are there some Mar-a-Lago moments in that book? What are they?
Yes, George, we've got a couple of Mar-a-Lago moments in the book that are really, really interesting. You know, the details of what goes on at Mar-a-Lago are not known. We do know, you know, who's coming off the plane, and you and I are on the tarmac, and we see Bob Woodward was able to read two specific incidents at Mar-a-Lago.
And what were those incidents?
Well, the first one had to do with the picking of the new national security advisor after Michael Flynn left. That was President's Day weekend on 2017, and he goes into some really interesting detail about the conversations.
Right. So I remember, and we reported it was at Mar-a-Lago that he named H.R. McMaster as his national security advisor. That was known, and I remember I think they invited the media in for a little photo op. But what else does the Woodward book tell us about what went on at Mar-a-Lago that weekend?
Well, we know the McMaster from Woodward. We know that McMaster was not the only one interviewed. John Bolton was also interviewed. The details that are particularly interesting is that Steve Bannon gave McMaster a little briefing before he met with the president, specifically told him, you know, that the president was not someone that needed to have a background on a lot of details. And so McMaster went in, and apparently he didn't do very well in the interview, according to Woodward.
But he got the job. How did he get the job?
He got the job. He got the job partially because apparently the president did not like John Bolton's mustache.
Okay.
And initially, McMaster, during his first interview with the president, he was not wearing his uniform. And the second interview, he wore his uniform. The president was very impressed with that.
I like the idea, by the way, of Steve Bannon, who, you know, looks like he just rolled out of a van, giving advice to a military guy, H.R. McMaster, on how to be how to present himself. But go on. What was the other big Mar-a-Lago thing in the Woodward book?
The other thing that was really interesting were the details behind the April 5th, 2017 National Security Council meeting that Trump convened at Mar-a-Lago just before launching a missile strike on Syria.
Now, once again, this was something the White House put out a picture of the makeshift situation room in somewhere in Mar-a-Lago with all these folks sitting around the table contemplating the missile strike on Syria. So we did see that. But take us a little bit behind what else went on.
Well, you know, it was interesting because in this particular instance, the president really did seek out everyone's opinion on the situation. And he even went so far as to call the captains of the ships that where the missiles would be launched from, asking them, you know, making sure that everything technically would go well. And the interesting thing is he gave the go-ahead on the strike, and then he went and had dinner with Chinese President Xi. During dessert, he leaned over to President Xi and informed him that he had just launched 60 missiles, 59 of which hit, and President Xi apparently approved, and the dessert went on.
There you go. Dinner at Mar-a-Lago. Now, just one other quick note. You know, a lot of presidents spend time. Well, even in Florida, Harry Truman spent a ton of time down at the in Key West. I think it was called the Little White House. John F. Kennedy was also a part-time Palm Beacher. He was up the road on the Kennedy compound in Palm Beach, up the road from Mar-a-Lago. Reagan and W. Bush spent a lot of time at their ranches. And Trump spends a lot of time at Mar-a-Lago. Why is there anything different about the Mar-a-Lago compared to these other presidents spending a little downtime away from Washington?
Yes, in the other president's situations, those were their private residences, with the exception of Truman. Actually, the government owned that little White House down in Key West. But the other presidents, those were their private residences, so they were not open to the public. Mar-a-Lago, on the other hand, is not only President Trump's personal residence, it is also a for-profit business that the president owns. And so those people out there who have the money, it's over $200,000 to join the club.
Although Jeff Green, it should be noted, who I think is still a Mar-a-Lago member despite his efforts to get kicked out in the Democratic primary, Jeff Green hinted that nobody actually pays the full price. But anyways, yeah, go on. It is a private club.
It is a private club. It's pretty pricey to get in there and stay in there. Right. And if you're a member there, you're possibly going to have access to the president. He spends a lot of time in the dining room. He's among the public, which drives the Secret Service a little up the wall. But he often goes around and asks people for their opinions. And we had a recent report from ProPublica that there's a troika of Mar-a-Lago members who have had extensive influence over the policy of the Veterans Administration.
Right. And so you'll certainly want to read a little more about that. Christine had a comprehensive story recently. You can find it at mypalmbeachpost.com and other Gatehouse publications that goes into some of these specific folks and the influence that these Mar-a-Lago members have and the contact with the president that's, you know, not precedented with other with previous occupants of the White House. Anything else in the Woodward book that jumped out at you?
No, but if I could just expound a little bit on this situation. Sure. With the private residence, public business. There are a couple of watchdog organizations that are deeply concerned about who's influencing the president at Mar-a-Lago, and one of them has actually gone so far as to file a lawsuit seeking the visitor logs, not only at Mar-a-Lago, but at the president's other private and public places that he visits often. And that lawsuit so far has not been successful, but they really feel that it's important for the public to know who's influencing the president.
All right. And, you know, the season is coming up, and the Palm Beach Post will have extensive coverage of Donald Trump's visits to Palm Beach and Mar-a-Lago coming up in the season. So you'll want to follow mypalmbeachpost.com and the other Gatehouse publications for that. Well, let's move on. Let's go back to the governor's race. You know, we've talked about the polls and some of the horse race aspects of the race. Here's a little policy type of issue that came up recently. Ron DeSantis was in Boca Raton recently visiting a Jewish school, and it was kind of a twofer for him. One, it was a way for him to connect with Jewish voters, and we've talked about on the podcast before, Jewish voters lean Democratic, but Ron DeSantis has a long pro-Israel record in Congress, and Republicans are hoping to maybe peel away some traditionally Democratic Jewish votes because of that. So Ron DeSantis was at a Jewish school, but he was there also to talk about school vouchers. Thomas Cordy, our sound engineer, is going to cue up a clip of Ron DeSantis in Boca Raton recently.
They have about 25% of their students are on scholarship, the tax credit scholarship. And I think that is an example of parents having the option to choose the best education for their kids. That's an important distinction in the race. I will protect these scholarships. I will stand with those families. Mayor Andrew Gillum is committed to closing down the scholarship program, which would throw a lot of these kids into turmoil and deny them the ability to have the education of their choice.
Okay, so he's referring to Florida has something called the Tax Credit Scholarship Program, which allows corporations in Florida to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit off their state taxes if they contribute to these nonprofit organizations that then fund scholarships for lower-income students to attend private schools. It's more than 100,000 students are in that program. And there's about 40,000 other students in various other school voucher programs in Florida. And Democrats and the teachers union have long been very critical of these programs. They say that they drain resources from public schools. And Andrew Gillum, here's what Andrew Gillum recently said about the voucher program. Thomas Cordy is going to cue that up for us.
I think what we're going to have to focus on is ensuring that all of those tax revenues go into the public system. The voucherizing of the education system in the state under Republicans began under Jeb Bush in 1998. We've got to begin to bring that to conclusion.
Okay, so voucherizing, I like that verb. Gillum is saying that we got to bring that to conclusion. Now, his campaign has not elaborated exactly on what that means. I mean, whether that means, immediately terminating 100,000 or more of these scholarships. I doubt that's the case. But there's definitely a philosophical disagreement in the governor's race over these school vouchers. Gillum has also been critical of charter schools and the accountability, or what he says, lack of accountability of them. There's about 280,000 students in charter schools. So this is going to be this is just to give you a kind of a preview of that issue. You'll be hearing a lot more of in the governor's race. One thing will be, I mean, DeSantis has said basically that Gillum wants to take away all these vouchers, and the Gillum campaign hasn't come forward with a lot of specifics about exactly what he wants to do, but he does say his ultimate goal is to bring that to a conclusion. So we'll have to see what that means. John Kennedy, you were at that Gillum press conference about his education plan. How big an issue do you see this being, in just based on past campaigns?
It would seem that there's stark partisan differences here on this tax credit scholarship issue. Whether for Gillum, it's a little bit of a touchy subject, because even though he may be suggesting shutting down these vouchers, a lot of minority students benefit from them. And there is a very large cadre of supporters. And Gillum has overwhelming support from Black voters in this state. But he is going at a program right now that, the way it's been structured, it really helps a lot of Black families, it would appear. So a little bit dangerous. DeSantis, by contrast, is going pretty much for a standard Republican line, which is, expand these opportunities for students to go to places other than the public school system.
There you go. Zach Anderson, have you encountered a lot of have you seen the education issue getting much traction on the campaign trail this year?
It's always a big issue in Florida politics. The battle lines are pretty well drawn, and you don't really, the Democrats really have pushed hard against expanding vouchers and expanding charter schools. It's sort of Republican orthodoxy now that we need more school choice and that you need to expand vouchers and charter schools. So in some ways, I think DeSantis is sort of just checking a box here and saying that, I'm behind you, I'm behind the school choice movement. He didn't really flesh out a lot of his policy proposals during the primary and really coasted on the endorsement of President Trump. And now he's starting to get a little bit more into policy here. And so it's not surprising that he's really coming out hard for school choice.
Definitely. And just the one thing to keep in mind. So however this issue plays out, I mean, you're talking about, between vouchers and charter schools, you're talking about more than 400,000 students in Florida. So it's an interesting issue to keep an eye on. Well, another issue that we have been that we've talked about before is red tide, and whether that's going to be a factor in the Senate race between Rick Scott and Bill Nelson. In our effort to cover every nook and cranny of Florida politics, John Kennedy recently covered a meeting of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. And Thomas Cordy is going to cue up another clip here from that meeting.
We all know that red tide is nothing new to Florida. Scientists at SWC, Milk Marine, and other institutions have made very clear people in Florida have noted the impacts of natural occurring algae on the Gulf Coast for hundreds of years. But that doesn't mean we don't work to see what we can do to mitigate the problems.
Okay. Now, we probably need a little interpretation for that. John Kennedy, did you go like full mob informant and wear a wire? How did you get that recording? That was Rick Scott. Explain what he's talking about there.
That's true. That may not be the best audio, but that was Rick Scott calling into the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, basically to defend his role before one of the lead agencies in trying to fight this red tide. Scott basically blamed Mother Nature for the what is a 145-mile red tide bloom, and that has led to massive fish kills, health warnings across a wide swath of the Gulf Coast. Many people that testified before this hearing this week said they've not seen anything this bad, and it does play to a political image that many Floridians have of Scott, who in his time, you know, he's cut funding for water management districts and he signed a law repealing septic tank inspections. Meanwhile, there's a separate freshwater toxic algae bloom that is filing waterways on both coasts. And a recent Florida Atlantic University poll showed about 32% of voters blame state government for the problem, although 38% acknowledge they don't know who's at fault. But it's kind of a problem for Scott as he's campaigning. And this week, he steered another $2.2 million toward efforts to ease red tide. And he's also asking the legislature to approve creation of a red tide research center next year. But, of course, that's when he'll be out of the governor's office. It's sort of like, you know, northern city mayors who rile up voters after failing to clear snow after a big snowstorm. This red tide and algae problem is stirring anger in Republican-leaning areas, basically, where Scott, you know, he should be welcome. But that's not good this close to an election.
And so, and Christine has covered a lot of water issues in her varied past at the Palm Beach Post. What's your thought on that?
Well, you know, several years ago, Scott was the target of protesters over here in Martin County and the Treasure Coast for the algae blooms that were fouling the St. Lucie waterway. And he came down here, and there were very strong protests. And in that case, he blamed the Army Corps of Engineers for the situation. So, you know, politically, that did not ding him, even though there was a large outcry. So it's interesting to see how he's handling this as compared to before.
Clearly, and clearly by, I guess he literally phoned it in to the Fish and Wildlife Commission there. But clearly, he's definitely seeing the need to respond and put forward some kind of explanation for the red tide. And as Christine mentioned, yeah, with the algae issue, there is that question of, you know, whether the federal government, what role the federal government plays in terms of managing the lake and all that kind of stuff. So, but I think that audio shows that this is something that's maybe causing some concern for Governor Scott in his Senate bid.
You know, one other small element about this is that this commission met in Gadsden County, which is about 50 miles from the Gulf Coast. It's one of only 32 Florida counties that are not on the coast. So, you know, it shows that Scott's campaign circuit is getting narrower and narrower, maybe.
Wow. That'd be a good pick a number there. 32 counties in Florida out of 67 are not on any coast. Is that right?
That's right. It was almost a pick a number this week, but that's sort of a pick a number bonus for you.
Bonus. All right. And speaking of pick a number, I believe I hear that funky royalty-free music playing again, which means that we are nearing the end of our podcast, but not before we... I know everyone's been waiting with bated breath to see what those numbers mean that we put forward earlier. So let's get to it. Let's go highest to lowest this week, just for kicks. John Kennedy, your number was 76.
Yeah, George, 76 is what I chose this week, and that's what Democratic Senator Bill Nelson, he's going to turn 76 this weekend. He's still a youngster in the United States Senate. California Senator Dianne Feinstein is the oldest current senator. She's 84. And, you know, historians remember South Carolina's Strom Thurmond made it to 100, leaving office just a few months before his death. But 65-year-old opponent Rick Scott, he's been running ads saying Nelson's been around too long in elected office for more than 40 years. And he has a new TV spot up this week saying that Nelson is confused again. So it's sort of playing towards some age images right there.
There you go. You got to be careful how you play that in a state like Florida, but you definitely see that from the young whippersnapper Rick Scott in the Senate race. Okay, very good number. Christine Stapleton, special guest this week, offered the number 17. Can you explain that to us, please?
Yes, 17 could actually be a twofer. I am not using 17 in the reference of QAnon's favorite number, 17. But instead, I am using 17 this week to represent the number of visits, presidential visits, that Trump has made to Mar-a-Lago since he was in office since January of 2017.
All right, 17. And that's a reminder. We'll get in a little plug for Palm Beach Post coverage and Gatehouse, Florida coverage of President Trump's visits that'll be coming up in the winter and spring. And you'll also want to see our Christine and I are part of the Ann Thomas Cordy, our sound engineer, very versatile. He's also a videographer and still photographer. We are all part of the Team Tarmac coverage whenever President Trump arrives in West Palm Beach. So you'll want to mark your calendars for that coming up in the probably November, December. Okay, moving on with pick a number. My number was 14. 14 is the gender gap in the recent in a recent poll of Floridians and their attitude toward whether Brett Kavanaugh should be confirmed for the Supreme Court. Now, this poll was taken after the initial accusation by Christine Blasey Ford, before some of the later ones. But what's interesting about it is there was a sharp difference in how men and women viewed the Kavanaugh nomination. 55% of Florida registered men, Florida voters, supported Kavanaugh's confirmation, only 41% of women. So clearly a big gender difference in how the Kavanaugh confirmation is viewed. And our last number, Zach Anderson with the number 4. Tell us what that means.
Well, George, we talked about red tide earlier, and my number is red tide related. On last week's podcast, we mentioned that Rick Scott was down in Venice, and he got met by a huge crowd of protesters who really disrupted a campaign event down there, and they were really upset about red tide. And after that protest, I counted 4 press releases from the governor's office within 3 days on red tide, on various issues, talking about increasing grant money, increasing funding for fish hatcheries to deplete fish stocks decimated by red tide. So we talked about DeSantis's campaign, and you know that they're struggling a little bit when they change their leadership. You know the governor is nervous about red tide when his office sends out 4 press releases in 3 days on the issue last week, and he already has twice addressed the issue this week. It is not an exaggeration to say that this is a huge, huge concern for people in this area. Some days when I go out of my building here in Sarasota, I can smell the red tide in the air. It's so pungent, the odor of this rotting sea life out there. And when Rick Scott was down in Venice for that protest, you could smell the red tide in the air. This is an issue that viscerally affects people. And in a tight election, it could have an impact.
Insightful number there. Thank you, Zach. Well, that brings us to the end of another Inside Florida Politics podcast. We are happy to have you listen. Once again, I am Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett. I've been joined here in studio by my colleague Christine Stapleton, making a special guest appearance. And I've been assisted here by our sound engineer, multi-talented Thomas Cordy. We've also had Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy from Tallahassee and Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson, and the man behind the curtain in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Adam Fish. Thank you.